UCCF's Be Thinking website, bethinking.org, offers you free access to some of the finest apologetics resources in the world. Make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to receive our monthly email. The BeThinking email is packed with handy information highlighting new articles, film, book and music reviews, and is filled with practical examples of how you can make good use of the excellent and insightful material on BeThinking.org to help you grow as a thinking Christian. BeThinkers combine a good understanding of the issues with a character that shows that the biblical truths that the BeThinker describes are authentic and life-changing. Log on to BeThinking.org and become a BeThinker today.
It's been a strange day today. When I woke up this morning, I was convinced that the millennium bug had struck. The Y2K thing was absolutely true because we woke up to these howling winds and no water. And I thought, all those scaremongers are actually right. I have to take back all those things I said about them in lunch discussions. But it's been a interesting day with a lack of water, doors blowing open all over the place, and a very cold house. But nice to see you all here. As many of you know, I like, if possible, to start my lectures with a Pink Floyd song, and because it matters, and because it's relevant. Not because I happen to like them, just because they speak to where we are. So I'm going to start now with a bit of a song, Money. This goes on forever, so I won't let you endure it forever. But this relates to stuff we're going to be looking at tonight. That song had quite an impact back in the late 70s with the Dark Side of the Moon album. Right, that's about the lightest note of the evening. I'm afraid that what I have to say tonight is not good news in so many respects. And I say that actually very seriously. This is a heavy lecture. Over the course of months and years, I've often set this aside simply because I found it a little bit too alarming and overwhelming. So before we begin, let's just pray together. Father, to a large degree, all of us are products of our culture and of our time. That is where you have placed us historically. And although you call us not to be conformed to the world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our minds, we recognize that conformity is constantly the impulse of our fallen humanity. And we want to be transformed. And we recognize that transformation comes, Lord, as we understand how the culture affects us. And as we look tonight at this dark subject of how the culture has impacted the modern self, I pray that you give us courage in listening. And Lord, I pray that you give us all clear minds. Many might not agree with all that's said, but I pray that you'd give us clear minds and help us to all be serious before this inquiry tonight. So, Lord, I pray this now in your Son's name, our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Now, over the past few years, I've become increasingly convinced that we have become a narcissistic culture. Narcissism, for those who aren't familiar with the term, is an extreme preoccupation with the self. And from my perspective, as I observe culture, in my contacts with people, as I read about the culture, I believe this phenomenon has become so widespread and so extreme that it actually constitutes a worldview. So when I talk about the worldview of self, I'm talking about this sort of narcissism. And within this worldview of self, I've been arguing that everything becomes so self-referential that one actually loses meaningful touch with objective reality. That's what happens within the worldview of self. Self becomes everything, and you actually lose touch with that which is outside of yourself. And for me, this phenomenon reflects what is perhaps the greatest satanic conspiracy of all time. It's a heavy statement, I recognize, but I believe it reflects what is perhaps the greatest satanic conspiracy of all times. The fact that we've been seduced into the self to such a degree that we've been removed from the other. We've lost touch with the real. That is a very, very serious state of affairs. Now, I've addressed this subject over the months and years from a number of different angles. Last term, I gave a lecture in which I attempted an anatomy of the modern self. And I tried to look at what the self looks like within this framework, within this worldview, how this worldview impacts the modern self. Now, this is not the place to review this lecture, the lecture I did last term, but I do want here to emphasize one main point that I made last term, for those of you who weren't there. And this point is actually important to the content of tonight's lecture. In my lecture last term, I talked about what I called the problem of self-consciousness. The problem of self-consciousness. And this problem is simply that we cannot know ourselves. It is impossible for the self to know the self. So this means, and I'm not going to try and prove that point, I attempted that in my last lecture, I'll just state it as a fact tonight, we cannot know ourselves. That is an impossibility. And so this means that the more self-conscious we become, the more focused we become on ourselves, the more lost we become, because we can't know ourselves. And so we look at ourselves, yet we can't know ourselves, and we look even further, and we feel ghost-like. And we ask increasingly, who am I? This is the identity problem in the latter half of the 20th century. Added to this is the fact that the more lost we feel ourselves to be, the harder we try to get to know the self. So there's a tautology here. Self-consciousness, we look inward, we can't know the self, so we try all the harder to get to grips with it. And this means that the problem of self-consciousness actually locks us into a vicious cycle where we become trapped within the ghost of self. We become trapped within. And in that sense, we become narcissistic. We begin to lose touch with the other. And this is where a culture of narcissism is so destructive. It pushes us to a preoccupation with the self, and yet the more preoccupied we become, the more lost we feel ourselves to be. And finally, we get so lost in the self that we lose touch with that which is outside of us, the other or the real, whatever you want to call it. And when the self actually breaks contact with the real, a type of psychological death takes place. And this is what the myth, the Greek myth of Narcissus illustrates so movingly and accurately. That when you focus on yourself to the neglect of what's outside of yourself, eventually you kill yourself. And that is what I believe is happening psychologically with respect to the modern self. Now, what I want to ask tonight is this. How did we get to this point? How did we get here? Where did the worldview of self come from? Didn't happen in a vacuum. Where did this phenomenon come from? Now, there are various ways that one can analyze the causes of this phenomenon. One way would be to look at the causes from an ideological perspective. That is, focus on the way ideas have led to this phenomenon. And in this kind of analysis, I'd want to show how the worldview of self is actually rooted in the very fundamentals of modernism. But that's not tonight's lecture. But I believe the worldview of self is rooted right there in the beginnings of modernism, in what we call the Cartesian way. Another way of analysis would be to explore the causes of cultural narcissism at the sociological level. And when we do this, we're looking at the roots of modernity, not modernism, but modernity. And that's the line of inquiry I want to follow tonight. Modernity is a sociological phenomenon, unlike modernism, which is an ideological phenomenon. Whenever you see an ism on the end of a word, you're dealing with an ideology. We mustn't confuse the two here. We often use these terms quite sloppily. Modernity is a sociological phenomenon. Modernity is a fact, socially, where modernism is a theory. It's in the world of ideas. So modernity refers to the character of the world that we live in today. And to understand modernity, you have to look at the factors which have given rise to the development of our culture. That's how you understand modernity. And the key thing with respect to modernity is this. It's a world which human beings have created through the application of technique. And Hoskins reminds us that it's a bottom-up causation. It's a culture, a society, a world which is built from the bottom up. Human beings applying their technique, their designs, their systems in order to build a society. And modernity actually replaced an earlier world which was built from the top down. European society was largely built on God's revelation from the top down. Modernity is built from the bottom up. Now, in order to understand how modernity has been constructed, we need to go back to those major structural and institutional developments which have fundamentally shaped our world and the modern self. And most historians would root the genesis of modernity in the Industrial Revolution in the mid-18th century. And that's the line that I follow, that modernity started, the sociological phenomenon started with the Industrial Revolution. It's hard to place it exactly. There were features of it before that, going right back to the Enlightenment. But the Industrial Revolution is when modernity proper began. This revolution, the Industrial Revolution, brought rapid social and technological changes which have fundamentally changed our world. And what I want to do tonight is look at the social impact of this revolution and what has grown out of it, and how this therefore has impacted us as modern selves. So that's what I'm going to do tonight. And I want to start by looking at the Industrial Revolution itself, and some of the changes that it brought immediately, some of the main changes that I see it brought. Then I want to move to some of the smaller revolutions here which grew out of this major revolution. Sorry about the glare on the board, I'll use black ink next time. Just to say, my purpose is not to focus tonight on those factors which gave rise to these revolutions. I'm simply looking at the way they have impacted the self. And believe me, I recognize, I say this in anticipation of some questions to come from you sociologists here of PhDs, that I am dealing with major themes here with a very, very broad brush. But I'm hoping that painting like this will give you the big picture of why we've come to this point where we are today, locked into the worldview of self. So let's start with the Industrial Revolution. What I want to do here is look at two things that come directly out of the Industrial Revolution which have had a major impact on the modern self. The first of these is what I call the disintegration factor. The disintegration factor. I believe that the Industrial Revolution has brought about social changes as great as any other revolution in history. And for me, one of the greatest changes is in the divide which it brought between the public and the private spheres of our lives. This is the immediate social change that came out of the Industrial Revolution, this divide between the public and private spheres of our lives. You see, before the Industrial Revolution, almost the whole of the industrial base in society was in the cottage. It was in the home. You were a farmer. You were a weaver. You were a blacksmith. And in this model, home and work, private and public, were integrated. They were together. But with the coming of the Industrial Revolution, work was removed from the home to the factory. And in this model, the home remained the sphere of one's private world, while the factory, which became centralized, and it's interesting how the factory became centralized in the Industrial Revolution, often replacing the church in the center of towns. You go to the north of England, you see this often with the mills in competition with the church. So factories were centralized, and these became the public world. Home, your private world. The factory is your public world. Now, of course, there has always been some distinction between the private and public areas of individuals' lives. I think in most cultures, going to the toilet has always been a private affair, although there may be some exceptions to this. But that's a private affair, while going to the church or to your local temple was a public affair. But before the Industrial Revolution, the relationship between these two was a line. They were both connected. There was an integration between the two of these. So they were not totally unrelated to each other. But with the Industrial Revolution, a chasm has been created between the public and the private, which makes them almost different universes. And this is the disintegration factor. Now, on the one side of this chasm, you have the public worlds. And this is the world of what we might call the mega institutions. This is the world that government belongs to. Think of big government. This is the world of the mega corporations, the Microsofts of this world. This is the world of education, these massive authorities. This is the world of healthcare, and we could go on and on. Now, to the modern self, this public world seems very impersonal, which it is. This public world is very anonymous in its character. We never quite know who's in control of what. We have this term, faceless bureaucrats. It's anonymous to us. We can't get through to it. And most of us don't know quite how all this works. How do the financial markets really operate? It's all a bit strange to us and impersonal. And within this public world, the modern self feels depersonalized and anonymous. So the doctor in your ward doesn't know your name until he looks at the clipboard on the end of your bed. Says, oh, hello, Jeffrey. And your tax man doesn't know what you look like. He knows your name when he turns up your file, but he doesn't know what your face looks like. And we don't like being part of this public world. And yet, of course, we recognize that it's a necessary part of modernity. The public world provides me with employment. The public world does the necessary evils like collecting taxes and stuff like that, but we don't really like it. It's there, necessary, but we don't like it because of its impersonality. Now, on the other side of the chasm is our private world. And this is where the micro world of the family exists. And of course, to say that today is to say it in a very loose way, family in whatever form that takes today. And this is the world where my personal tastes really matter. Here's where I gain personality. Here's where I can follow my interests in sports and music and so forth. I define myself in this world, the private world. This is the one place in my existence where the self can be fulfilled and satisfied. And this is actually my one overriding concern in the private world, to satisfy the needs of myself. So it makes the private sphere like a kind of island where the real self lives. Out there, I'm a bit anonymous, I wear a uniform, I've got a number, but in this private world, here's where I really exist. This is who I really am. And this actually makes up what I'm denied in the public sphere. There I can't be myself. As I say, I'm just a number on the NHS register. But in the private world, I can be myself and build a world of my own to my heart's content. Now, I believe that this divide focuses attention on the self to an unprecedented degree. Why? Well, because the public world shrinks me and makes me anonymous. It depersonalizes me. It almost dehumanizes me. And this has actually drawn attention to the self in a way never known before. This impersonality of the public world has never existed like this. And suddenly, we feel insecure about ourselves. So now I'm going to try and find myself in the sphere of the private. This is the only way I can really be myself. Something one before the Industrial Revolution never would have thought of. You wouldn't have thought of how can I be myself. And my point is that all of this brings a heightened awareness of self-consciousness. In the public world, I feel self-conscious. There's something I don't like. It shrinks me. It cuts me down to a zero. So I want to move into this other world where I can find my true self. Now, this divide between the public and private also impacts the self because it causes a type of schizophrenia. You know, for most of us, just to get to work every morning, we have to move from one world to another. It's like two different worlds. Going from home to work, for most of us, is like traveling to a parallel universe. And you know, at work, it's very rare that anyone knows you there like they know you at home. Because it's such a different world. They're so radically different. So you're forced to take on a new self as you enter this new world. You cannot be the same person in both places. Because they're such different worlds and they demand such different responses. Now, this actually creates a spiritual, moral, and intellectual schizophrenia. The fact that I'm so different within these two worlds. In fact, you know, I have to say as an aside, I believe this is why so many affairs happen today. Why men go off with other women, women go off with other men. I've been astounded by this at times. Homes that, to a large degree, seem fairly functional, marriages which seem together, and yet people go off with someone else. Why? I believe it's this type of schizophrenia. They're two different people in two different places. And as I've observed this over the years, it's one of the few things that has got to the root of this phenomenon. The fact is the modern self becomes so fragmented between these different worlds, the public and the private. Now, for many of us today, we're actually forced to occupy multiple worlds. And I think the Christian gets the worst end of the deal here. You've got the world of home. You've got the world of work. If you're a Christian, you've got the world of church. And then most of us have the fourth world, the world of our social contacts, our social worlds. And you know, often there is little, if any, continuity between these various worlds. We're four almost completely different people in those worlds. There's hardly any connection between them at all. And that, I suggest, makes the self feel very schizophrenic. The radically different nature of each of these worlds, all separate from each other, forces us to wear a number of different masks. And this makes the self feel very transient and ghost-like, and again, it increases the problem of self-consciousness. The last problem, briefly, I want to mention here, all of these I throw out really almost just by way of headers, of headings. The last problem caused by this divide between public and private is this, that our private worlds, that's the place where the self finds its true fulfillment, our private worlds are actually very fragile. Very, very fragile. Think about it. We have to change jobs. And suddenly that shatters one of our private worlds. And with the change of job, we have to change our house. We get a divorce. That changes our private world again. The kids grow up and move away. It changes it one more time. And on and on and on it goes. So as Os Guinness points out, for every mini-world we construct, another collapses. As we construct one private world, we deconstruct another. Happens every time. You can't keep them all. They're very fragile. And you know, this actually makes the private sphere a very insecure and vulnerable place for the modern self, because it's such a small world. And this constantly changing landscape of our private worlds make us withdraw more and more into the self. The self becomes the one safe haven we can stay in. Again, I've been asking myself for years, why are we so afraid of taking risks today? Why are we so afraid of commitment? And I believe this is one of the reasons why. In our private worlds, we experience all this fragility, all this vulnerability. Things keep shifting and changing. And so we just close into ourselves and say, no more risk. It's all too much for me. Well, that's the disintegration factor that has helped produce the worldview of self. The second here is the consumer factor. The consumer factor. The Industrial Revolution created a social context that has given rise to what we call the consumer culture. We had a lecture on Christianity and the consumer culture earlier this term. Now, I think it's important to know that consumerism did not exist before the Industrial Revolution. Up until that moment, everyone was a producer. So if you were a farmer, you worked your small holding to feed your family, and with your extra, if you had it, your extra produce, you use that for bartering. It was exactly the same with weavers. If you were a tradesman, you were still a producer. It was only after the Industrial Revolution that the consumer was created. Now, just after the Industrial Revolution took place, employers still tended to see their employees as producers. They were there to produce for them. That's what they were there for. And the employer couldn't care less what the workers did with their leisure time. What they did in their private worlds was their concern. And I think then that few could see ahead in those early days of the Industrial Revolution. They didn't make the connection that a society based on mass production requires the organization of mass consumption too. If you have mass production, you have to have mass consumption. Now, it was only with the Industrial Revolution that mass production became possible. So the factory is now capable of producing goods in mass quantities, food, clothing, utensils. As I say, this required mass consumption. And that's where the necessity of the consumer came in. The Industrial Revolution could only flourish if consumption became a way of life. That's the only way it could carry on. Now, it's interesting. When mass consumption became a way of life for the modern with respect to the basic necessities of life, that is, food and clothing, it then became necessary for the Industrial Revolution or its entrepreneurs to find new areas in which to mass produce. And it's important to remember here that the impulse that lay behind the Industrial Revolution was all about development and progress. That's what modernity is about. Progress, progress, progress. And that's why it was inevitable that the proprietors of the Industrial Revolution would look for new things to mass produce. They've covered the basic necessities. Well, let's move on to new things. And in order to do this, it had to create new consumer demands beyond food, beyond clothing, beyond basic utensils. Now, the Industrial Revolution still had to work within the laws of supply and demand. That's how economics works. If there's a demand, you supply in order to meet that demand. Dangerous to go beyond it. And for a culture that was increasingly becoming privatized, this was relatively easy. Remember, I've said that the true self is only found in the private sphere. And remember that the modern self now looks to the sphere for personal fulfillment. That meant that the producer simply had to lock into that private world, where the self really found itself. So in order to promote consumption in the sphere of the private world, all you have to do is convince people that mass-produced commodities have the capacity to confer status and prestige. These commodities can fulfill your modern self. you can find yourself in these consumer items. Now, the perfect device for passing on this message was advertising. Advertising is, again, a post-industrial phenomenon. And advertising, interestingly, has never been primarily a device to advertise the merits of a product. It's never been the main purpose of advertising. Advertising is something which promotes consumption as a way of life. So in a privatized culture, advertising actually manufactures a product of its own, which is the consumer. Advertising creates the consumer. And to make consumption a way of life, this is what was needed. If you're going to have mass production beyond the basic necessities, advertising simply needed to touch base with a modern self and show that consuming is a way to satisfy and fulfill the needs of the self. Now, briefly, the way advertising does this and has always done it is to generate boredom and restlessness. What you need to do is make one feel the inadequacies of their present situation and show how a new consumer item can change all of that. And that is exactly what has been happening since the Industrial Revolution. Through the means of advertising, it has created the consumer by making us perpetually bored and restless. Now, it would be very hard to overestimate how radically this defines the modern self, that is you and I, how fundamentally we are consumers. The modern self as consumer determines how we approach almost everything in life today. It defines the character of the modern self to the core of our beings. And that is why we need to see that consumerism has radically impacted the modern self, coming directly out of the Industrial Revolution. Consumerism is a totally self-referential way of existence. But it's because it's something which is totally constructed around the needs of the self. So the self is central to the consumer model of life. And a number have pointed out that consumerism is a worldview very similar to that of Descartes, with only one slight difference. Descartes says, I think, therefore I am. Modern consumerism says, I shop, therefore I am. As some smart wag said, Tesco's ergo sum, rather than cogito. Tesco's ergo sum. Tesco's for you Americans and Europeans is one of the biggest British supermarkets. Point is, consuming is how the self is authenticated. That is what modernity has created us to be consumers. Now, to my mind, consumerism is a form of prostitution. It's the best metaphor I can grasp in order to understand consumerism. It's a form of prostitution. Because the consumer culture promises the self a handsome payout if we'll just sell our bodies to the night. But the price for the self is slavery. So at the Industrial Revolution, consumerism asks the modern self to jump into bed with him. For doing so, we've been paid out very well. Think of all the benefits that's come to us through consumerism. It's paid wonderful dividends. But to play this game, we've had to surrender self to the demands of consumerism. We've had to fall into that model. And it's a type of slavery from which there's no escape. It's a form of modern prostitution. And it's a slavery that all of us are a part of. There is no one who belongs to the modern world who is not a consumer. You know, we don't cease to become consumers because we start doing our shopping at charity shops. You don't cease to become a consumer when you start growing your own organic vegetables. Sorry, folks. You're still well within the consumer framework. In fact, you know, I want to put in a good word for asceticism. This term, I've heard so many negative things about asceticism, but I want to defy anyone to try and be an ascetic today. I'd love to see an ascetic in the modern world. I'd love to see someone who doesn't fit the consumer model. I say, let's go ahead and try, because I'd blow me down if we could actually make it. That's how much consumerism shapes us. That's the first revolution, the industrial, the major one that has had a major impact on the self. The second is the technological revolution. Now, I'm considering the technological revolution as something which is separate to the Industrial Revolution. And I acknowledge that certainly in the Industrial Revolution, the possibility of this was because of amazing new technological innovations. Without these innovations, the Industrial Revolution wouldn't have happened. But it is my opinion that the Industrial Revolution actually created conditions which has brought technology to a new place within our culture. And because of the Industrial Revolution, the modern self relates to technology in a very new way. Now, in order to understand how technology has impacted the modern self, it's important to understand how it functioned in culture before the Industrial Revolution. So there's a bit of history here. Follow me if you can. It's important for us to see that technology is not new to our world. It's not post-industrial. Human beings have always used technology. We've always used tools and techniques to facilitate our life here in this universe. And it's important to see the relationship of technology to culture and to self as we look back. Now, my thinking here is being guided and shaped by Neil Postman, who wrote a wonderful book called Technopoly. And in this book, Postman highlights three significant phases which help us to understand this new relationship. The first phase, historical phase, is the tool-using cultures. Up until the 18th century, all cultures were tool users. And these tools were used to do two things. First of all, they were used to solve the specific and urgent problems of physical life. That is, water power, windmills, heavy wheel plows, and so forth. How you survive. That's why you use your tools to survive physical life. The second function, which is very important to understand, is this. Tools, technology, serve the symbolic world of art, politics, myth, ritual, and religion. Example, the construction of... And technology was geared very specifically in the tool-using culture to serving that symbolic world. Now, the important point here to stress is this, that tools, technology, did not attack and undermine the beliefs of these cultures. Technology didn't prevent people from believing in their traditions, their gods, their politics, their methods of education, and so forth. In fact, the beliefs which undergirded cultures were in control, and they shaped the use of tools. So this meant that technology was integrated into these cultures in ways that did not pose significant contradictions to its worldview. So theology, mythology, and philosophy served as the controlling ideology for technology. That's the first phase, pre-Enlightenment. The second is a technocracy. A technocracy. And this happened at the Enlightenment during the 18th century. Here a significant change took place, and Europe became a technocracy. Where previously beliefs within a culture were dominant, now beliefs and tradition begins to lose their grip. And this was because the Enlightenment was the age of reason. And in the age of reason, human intellect and reason was set free to conquer the world. And human reason is set free from tradition and belief, because these held us back. That's what the Enlightenment was about. Now that's why this new movement set off the Age of Invention. You can almost call the Enlightenment the Age of Invention. From the Enlightenment onward, one new technology after another enters the picture. Alfred North Whitehead says this, "Really the greatest invention of the Enlightenment was the idea of invention itself. We had learned how to invent things, and the question of why we invent things receded in importance. The idea that if something could be done, it should be done was born at this time." So this was the age of technocracy. And in such a world, technology begins to play a central role in the thought world of the culture. And everything, including tradition and beliefs, must give way in some degree to their development. Now this made for an uneasy tension between the technological world and the traditional world, the world of religion and philosophy. The citizens of a technocracy knew that science and technology did not provide philosophies by which you could live, so they still clung to the beliefs of the fathers. But in a technocracy, tools are no longer integrated into the culture, they actually bid to become the culture. They attack it. And as a consequence, tradition, ritual, religion, philosophy, mythology, these have to fight for their lives. That's the second phase. The third is where we are today. And this is what Neil Postman calls technopoly. It's a wonderful term. The more I reflect on this word, the more significant it becomes for me. Technopoly. This is the world we live in the 20th century. And in such a world, technology no longer challenges the existing culture. It becomes the culture. It takes control and it rules supremely. And it's unrivaled by anything else. That's what a monopoly does. It's supreme. It has no rivals. That's where technology is in our culture today. And I believe it's because of technopoly that we've witnessed the virtual disappearance during the 20th century of religion and tradition. These have disappeared. Technology rules in the modern world. And its former rivals have become largely irrelevant. Religion isn't relevant to life today. It's okay for someone in the private world, but it's not really relevant. Now, this all started back at the Enlightenment when the whole idea of God came under attack. That's what happened during the technocracy. The idea of God comes under attack. And the Enlightenment begins to remove the whole transcendent realm. Now, into the 20th century, God has virtually been removed altogether. Think of the pronouncement of Nietzsche. Looking back to the Enlightenment, God is dead. So the transcendent realm, God has been removed almost altogether. And it's here that technology fills the gap which is left by God's absence. And it manages to fill the gap left by God's absence because it actually has the power to change our world for good. Technology improves our lot. And that's why we have willingly deified technology. Don't forget that technology scratches us where we itch today. This is right at the point of our consumer mentality. I find my needs fulfilled within the private sphere. So technology might not be able to tell us the meaning of life, but it fulfills the needs of the self. And for the consumer self, that's all that matters, to fulfill my needs. And that's why technology has become a monopoly today. It's eliminated all its alternatives. That's why we've submitted all forms of culture to the sovereignty of technique and technology. And it's been a very good replacement. Never forget this. Technology has provided us with convenience, comfort, speed, hygiene. You can go on and on and on and on. And these gifts are so obvious that there seems to be little reason to look to any other source for fulfillment and purpose. So with technology on the throne, who needs a transcendent God? Now, we live today in a world where there's what you might call conceptual debris. There's nothing left to believe in that realm. There's nothing metaphysical that you can say gives a meaning to life. But the one sure thing that remains is technology. That's always there, and it satisfies us in the private sphere as consumers. So we've surrendered ourselves to this God. Now, I want to suggest that technopoly has seriously impacted the modern self. How's this? Well, I believe it's radically redefined the relationship of the self to reality. And it's done this by functionally making the metaphysical realm disappear. The metaphysical realm is the realm which is above physics, above that which science can deal with. It's the transcendent reality. You see, before technopoly, the metaphysical realm determined so much of culture. It was so important to culture. The beliefs and traditions which undergirded culture made people wide open to this realm, to the transcendent realm. But technopoly has eliminated everything transcendent and reduced everything to the imminent, to the here and now. That's what you might call practical atheism. That's what technology has produced. Reality now is reduced purely to the physical and the material. As I say, the metaphysical has gone. So that means reality now is all about the existential. That's what touches my existence. If you can't experience it sensually, it doesn't exist. That's what technopoly has created. That's where most of us are today. You judge reality by what impacts you. So in the end, this reduces reality to experience. If you experience it, it's real. If you don't, it's not. And that's where technopoly has taken us. In the private sphere, as consumers, with self at the center, seeking for our needs to be satisfied, technology does a wonderful job of touching us and improving our lot. And so it's reduced everything to that realm. Everything's there. And everything is being redefined according to this radical principle of immanent experience, that which touches the self within the private sphere. So technology actually redefines what we mean by religion, art, family, politics, history, truth. All of these things are reduced to this existential dimension. God exists if you experience Him. And all our definitions of all these things have to fit the new requirements of a technopoly. So what this means for us, say, in the realm of relationships is this. If you don't have an existential experience of something, it's not real. Reality is measured by its impact in the body, by physical sensations. So in a technopathy, the self is at the center and reality is what happens to you. And this, I suggest, has seriously distorted our whole relationship to the real. It's made a massive contribution to the world view of self. It's detached us from reality and made us redefine how we think of the real. Let me move on now to the graphics revolution. The graphics revolution. The American historian Daniel Boorstin has talked extensively about what he calls the graphic revolution. He actually coined this phrase in his book, The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America. Brilliant book. The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America. Still in print, just being reprinted. Now, the graphics revolution is closely related to the technological revolution I've just covered. And the graphics revolution began with the photograph. This was the piece of technology that brought this revolution to birth. And I want us to see that this revolution has fundamentally changed the way we relate to the real. It's completely redefined how we think of reality. Now we need to begin by appreciating that until the appearance of the graphic image, the photograph, that's where it began, typography, that is the written word, was the medium for representing the real. So the primary symbols or signifiers within reality were human language. This is how we made sense of reality. Word signs gave meaning to what was there. It helped us interpret the world outside of us. And that, of course, is also how paintings functioned. They had symbolic value. They operated as signs or signifiers to interpret the world and to make it meaningful. Now, my point is this, that after the graphics revolution, the word is replaced by the image. That's what happened. The word is replaced by the image. And it's important to understand that the new imagery didn't function merely as a supplement to language. It tended to replace it as our dominant means for understanding and testing reality. So in the wake of the graphics revolution, we tend to by means of images. If you see it in an image, it must be real. This is the seeing is believing mentality, which is so common in our world. Most of us feel instinctively that a graphic image is the truest record of reality. If you see it in a picture, it has to be true. It has to be real. And this means that the graphic image has become much more powerful as a signifier than the printed word. Now, I'm not saying here that the printed word has no power. I'm just simply saying that it's taken second place to the graphic image. That's a major shift. Now, we need to appreciate how far-reaching the graphic revolution has been. You think of the place of the video image within our culture today. Television, film, how often in a day, now just going into a shoe shop and there's some television there, graphic images. Think of all the computer graphics that we're surrounded by today. Think of all the mass-produced photographs that we see in advertising, between 2,000 and 3,000 a day apparently. Now we can't begin to compute how many graphic images we're surrounded by all the time. And all of these are very powerful, and each shapes the way we deal with reality. We have the perception that because I see it, it's real. Now, this trend has gone so far that a number of social commentators have actually said that graphic images actually now have blurred the distinction between image and reality. Because of the graphic revolution, the two, image and reality, have become essentially one. The distinction is being broken down. Now, this is a rather complex argument that I can't develop in detail because I don't understand it all. But the gist of it goes like this. The sign, which is the graphic image, actually replaces the real. It replaces it. The image actually becomes the real in our perception rather than a symbol which points to the real. That's what signs are doing. Signs are meant to point beyond to the real, to the signified. But now the image actually becomes the real in our perception. So the graphic image becomes a signified rather than being a signifier or a sign which interprets the real. So rather than representing the real, that's what we think images ought to do, that's what paintings do, graphic images actually replace the real. Now one of my favorite contemporary philosophers is a Frenchman by the name of Jean Baudrillard. I don't know why I like him, because he's so obtuse in his writing and so hard to get to grips with. But behind it all, when you work with it, he says some amazing things. And he's called this phenomenon I'm describing simulacra. Simulacra. From the word simulate. Now, the true meaning of simulate means to feign or to fabricate what is not there in the first place. That's what a simulation is. You fabricate what's not there in the first place. So it doesn't work from something which is present and real, and then you represent that. No, it actually works from what isn't even there in the first place. And Baudrillard uses the illustration of the map, where the cartographer actually generates a map without any reference to the landscape. He just makes it up out of his own head. And Baudrillard actually believes that the graphic image today functions in such a way as to generate models of the real without reference to the real. And these images create what he calls hyper-reality, or the hyper-real. It's another way of saying that images are no longer functioning as signs and signifiers, but they've actually become real in our imagination. So this actually threatens the difference between true and false, and between real and imaginary. But what I find fascinating about Baudrillard's argument is this, that he actually justifies his argument by going back to the Old Testament. And what he does is look in the Old Testament at the strong prohibitions against idolatry. He asks, why was God so strongly against the making of images of himself? You must not make any graven images. Why? Now, I don't think Baudrillard gets to the heart of the reason, but he makes an interesting point that I'm taken by. He says because God would become lost in simulacra. It goes like this, that graven images of God have this facility of ultimately erasing God from the consciousness of the people. The image actually eats up the real and supplants it, and becomes the real itself. So in the end, we take the image, the idol, for God himself. The idol has been lost. Simulacra has taken place. Now, if this argument is correct, if this is what the graphic image does to us in our culture, and I believe it is correct, then the consequences are terrifying. Firstly, because graphic images are a relatively new phenomenon. They haven't been around that long. The graphic revolution started at the beginning of the century, but it hasn't taken off until the last 30 years. So we haven't yet been able to properly assess the impact of all these images on our humanity, on ourself, on the way we deal with reality. And secondly, I find it terrifying just because of the sheer number of them that we're exposed to. If these, as I believe they do, radically impact how we relate to the real, we begin to see the images as signified, we lose touch with the real, we've got a terrifying thing taking place. And I find this so shocking because as a Christian, I believe that anything that disconnects us from the real is destructive of our humanity. Schaefer said, God calls us to live in the circle of reality, dealing with things as they are. Christianity loves the real, even though it spoils. That's how we're called to respond to life as Christians. We're responding to things as they really are. So we use the appropriate symbols, but those symbols are focused on what's there, the real. Now, if the self is no longer dealing with the real, then there is nothing substantial left for it to gain its moorings from. We're lost then. It's a free-floating world. We're lost in the world of the hyper-real. And I believe that the graphics revolution has seriously contributed to the worldview of self in this way. One example, I've used it before. I believe actually it's much more subtle than this. This is actually a bad example because it's too obvious. This simulacra happens at such a subtle level, it's hard to get behind. But many of you heard me tell the story of the time the Fellows families were hatching chicks from eggs in an incubator. And the long-awaited day arrived, and we were all terribly excited and ran through the house shouting the good news that the chicks were coming out. They were hatching, and we invited students to come over, to pour over, and to see this marvelous sight. And I met one student in the basement, and I said to him, you must come. Our chicks are hatching out. And he said, I've seen it before. I said, well, it doesn't matter. Come and see it again. He says, I've seen it before. I said, well, where'd you see it? He said, I saw it on television. I said, you've never seen it before. He said, I have. I saw it on television. And we got into this argument that lasted too long, because I probably missed another chick hatch out, of the fact that he did not see chicks hatching out. He saw a simulacra of it, a representation of it, but he didn't see the real thing. But in his mind, he had. And he didn't need to walk over to our house. He'd already seen it. Let me move on quickly. Fourthly, the information revolution and how this has impacted the modern self, brought us to what I call the worldview of self. The technological revolution in our society has also given rise to the modern information revolution. Now, it was back again at the beginning of the 20th century that we witnessed a marked increase in the amount of available information. And this came through the new technologies of the telegraph and the photograph. With these two, there were new possibilities for shifting larger amounts of information around the world at much higher speeds. In fact, it was a dramatic change in the world. With the telegraph, you could have today's news today. You'd never been able to have that before. Even within your own town, you didn't get it on the same day. If you lived in the next town, you got it 2 days later. If you lived in the next city, you got it a week later. The telegraph ensured you got the news today. So this transfer of information, larger amounts, greater speeds. Now, as the century progressed with the invention of the radio, the television, and computers, think of cyberspace, the possibilities for the transfer of information has increased dramatically. And now there are possibilities for unprecedented amounts of information and at vastly increased speeds. It's incredible what technology has made possible with respect to the transfer of information. And this has given rise to what I call the information revolution. And again, it's a relatively new phenomenon. We're not talking ancient history here, folks. This is all fairly new, and we're trying to grapple with how it's affecting us. Now, it's noteworthy that the rise of the information revolution coincided with the moment of increasing problems within our culture. The 20th century has been a painful discovery of this fact, that modernity has not become the utopia we thought it would become. Last century, we really thought we were heading for heaven, heaven here on earth. We would eradicate all of our problems. But this century, we've had two world wars, which have utterly devastated Europe. We've had the major breakdown of the family. We've had a number of economic crises. We're still having to deal today with life-threatening diseases, cancer, and then we've got things like AIDS to deal with. We've got rising crime, etc., etc., etc. Modernity is not utopia. Now, in the face of all these crises, our culture is held to the belief what we need to solve our problems is more information. I believe we really believe that today. If we get enough information on the subject, we can crack the problem. So that's how you defeat crime today. You gather lots of information about why people offend. And you collate all this information together and you write a huge long report. And you submit that report to government or to whoever, to the school, and you read it and you think, oh great, now we've got the information, this is the problem. We live in a world which is so enamored by reports and surveys. The other day it was reported humorously, but there was a report on Radio 4 about a survey which had been carried out about why people fall on wet floors. And someone had been paid £50,000 to do this work on why people fall on wet floors. Now, I could tell you for 50 pence. Just give it to me now and I'll tell you. But if you pay someone £50,000 and put it in a report and a survey, and it becomes really impressive. For some, anyway. See, if you have a report, you've got something which is authoritative. This is going to solve the problem. That's our mentality with respect to information. Now, in saying all of this, we mustn't undermine the importance of data and information in our lives. This is very important. It's through means of our information we're given that we formulate a vision of the world around us. We use information in order to interpret the universe we live in. So in this sense, information is absolutely critical. I'm not against information tonight. Without it, the self could not function in his or her world. But I would contend, however, that the information revolution has actually brought great harm to the modern self. This is because we're bombarded by information at such high quantities and at such great speed that it no longer makes contact with reality. Here again you see the break with reality. So that data or information which is meant to help us integrate our existence into reality actually cuts us off from the real. And I make this assertion because the information revolution has rejected the necessity of interconnectedness. Everything in this world is interconnected in some way. The information revolution rejects that. Now it's interesting, some more recent writers have talked about the interconnectedness of information with respect to cyberspace. It's all interconnected in there in some way. But I would say that cyberspace, again, in some respects, is quite disconnected from reality. But the fact is, information comes to us in little sound bites that are almost completely severed from a wider context. That's what the information revolution is about. Sound bites. Lots of sound bites. So on the news today, we received sound bites of information that Russians are trying to take the capital of Grozny and so many people were killed by a missile attack last night. And little, if anything, is said about the history of that conflict and how that conflict connects with other neighboring countries. Doesn't happen. A little bit of music, talk about the conflict, ooh, a little soundbite, move off to something else. Did you hear about those five ducklings that crossed the road, whatever? So you see, information here is about instancy rather than historical continuity. Information has become about fascination instead of complexity and coherence. And today we're surrounded by millions of little soundbites of information which actually make very little contact with reality. And this has actually created a new kind of world. It's the peekaboo world, where this event and then that event pops into view for a moment, then it vanishes. All over the place. Now, the complications of this phenomenon increase when you see that all of this information revolution, is taking place in a world where there is no transcendent sense of purpose or meaning. We live in a world, you can call it a postmodern world, you can call it what you want, but we could live in a world where there's actually no meta-narrative where this information fits into. And that means all these sound bites actually have no place to go. There's no pattern which it fits. There's no higher purpose which it serves. It's just there. And so we're kind of washing around in all this information. So this information that we're dealt out today is incapable of answering the fundamental human questions of life. So in this sense, too, the information revolution is cut off from reality. Now, as I said earlier on this point, we think in our world that information is our friend, that it can help us. Put it in a report and we think, yes, we can conquer the problem. But my worry is this, that this is one more phenomenon of the modern world which disconnects us from the real. And it removes itself yet one more step from objective reality. And in this, it creates a type of narcissism. Finally and briefly, that's what they all say, isn't it? Finally and briefly. Do you guys believe that anymore? Finally and briefly.
I saw it on television.
Did you? Was it real? Finally and at great length. No, I'm kidding. This is going to be brief. The global revolution. And this is a massive subject. All of these things are. I'm commenting on all of them rather briefly. But I just want to point out the global revolution. The forces which came out of the Industrial Revolution have given rise to the globalization of our worlds. And over the past 50 years, our world has become a monolithic society. And I believe all of the revolutions I have mentioned tonight have contributed to this globalization. All of these have created the conditions for the global revolution. Now, I believe this globalization has impacted the modern self in a number of significant ways. And tonight I just want to mention one which I frequently observe here at LaBrie, and it's this. That the global revolution has brought a loss of place. The global revolution has brought a loss of place. I see this, and I've seen it more than once here, when LaBrie students have pulled out atlases of the world and say, where am I going to live next? As if it's something very, very exciting. And I don't find it exciting at all. I find it heartbreaking. Because it reflects this global revolution and the loss of place which the human has. Now, why is it a problem? Well, simply because the sense of place is so important to our humanity, to the human self. It's the condition of our embodiment. I always occupy a place. So place matters. Place is important to the well-being of the self. Not an arbitrary thing, it matters. That's part of the essence of my humanity. I'm a creature of place. And you know, it's the sense of place, of belonging somewhere, that offers wonderful possibilities for historical continuity in our lives. And that's so good for the self. In a real sense, I believe we can become ourselves by relating to familiar places that are full of associations. That place where we've been celebrating Christmas since we were born. The tree there in the corner, oh yeah, that old thing on top of the tree, I don't know what it is now. So old and battered, but it's beautiful. And those smells from the kitchen? Sense of place. You see, place actually provides a kind of geography for our imagination. And it connects us with communities which carry us beyond ourselves. When you have a sense of place, it's a place with other people, your family, your neighbors. This is broken down so much in this global revolution, but that's what place gives you. And that takes you beyond yourself because it places you in a community. That's the opposite of narcissism, which is this inward preoccupation of the self. The old-time sense of place broke out of that model before this revolution. And sadly, when we look at the globalization factor, we see that it has increasingly made us placeless people. My wife Helen calls it the rootless phenomenon. The rootless phenomenon. I'm not saying anything pejorative or mean or nasty to any student here tonight, but this is true of so many of you guys who come through. You come to La Brie and it's where next? So many today have become rootless for all sorts of reasons. Often not our own choices, sometimes they are a result of our own choices. And this rootless phenomenon is part of the global world. The global world is one of mobility, moving around. It's so easy to move today, and this uproots us from place. We can move there, we can move there. The global world is one of economic rationalization. I could get a better job, so I'll change my job, I'll go there, and we justify it for economic reasons. And this too uproots us from place. Now I say this with some feeling, because I uprooted from Canada. But actually, that wasn't the most severe uprooting I've had. I actually uprooted from a place where my wife had been rooted for all of her life, in family, in community. It was a huge thing to come down here. And we're thankful that the Lord has led us here. But I see increasingly what this has done, what we gave up in doing that. It was a very serious thing. And of course, as we become increasingly placeless, we become even more removable. You move once and you move twice. And that's true of me. I moved from Canada to Bradford down here. I can live anywhere now. Now, some would say that's good. You're like Abraham. But I'm not so sure. In fact, I'd want to argue even theologically that place is important. It's not a cultural anachronism. It's a biblical thing. Remember in the Old Testament, God gave land to the people, specific land for families. That was important. Once you move once, you become removable, and it's easy to always be on the road. I believe this is why the beat poets of the 60s are so popular now. Kerouac, on the road, never settle, constantly moving, traveling, traveling. And if we ever do gain a sense of place as we move along, it's largely a private sense of space. It's reduced to our personal experience. It's not rooted into community. You see, because we're cut loose from community, we have no instrument to take us beyond ourselves. And of course, as we travel, we become global consumers. And it's hard not to be a global consumer today, even with a sense of place. But as I say, I love going to Lis and going to Udu. Seeing David there. He's my local man. It gives me a sense of place. I love that. Going to the greengrocers. It matters. So rather than being global consumers of these global conglomerates, you never know where it comes from, the idea of place, participating in the produce of your community, the farmer, the grocer, etc. So sadly, the global revolution has made us rootless people, and this is a disturbing trend. And I would suggest that this is seriously impacted the modern self. Well, that's as far as I want to travel tonight. It's not been a feel-good lecture, I recognize. And this is a very, very negative picture of modernity. I want to concede before I close that there is much about modernity which has been good. But my point tonight is this, that in the way it's impacted the self, it's been a very, very negative thing. Very negative thing. Terrifying thing. And that's the point I want to make. It's not the purpose of my lecture tonight to look at how we can escape from the worldview of self, which is brought on by these revolutions. That's where I hope to go next time. And if you don't mind, I will not answer questions tonight in detail about how we escape this. That's the subject of another lecture. This is to show where we are. And perhaps in my next lecture on a Friday, I'll look at where we go within this framework. Right. Let me leave it there.
Leave it
on, yeah. Thank you. Thank you, boss. Zach?
two questions. The first is, I was curious why many of you didn't include urbanization and the city as part of this flow, particularly related to the Industrial Revolution.
Yep.
And because it does seem to have become such a central focus for modernity and even modernism, and a focus for the arts and the literature and the thinking that's come out of that. And so I'm curious why that doesn't play maybe a larger role.
Yep. That's a helpful observation. I can't honestly say that I left it out purposefully. I think I could bring it into a number of points. The Industrial Revolution, the Global Revolution, there's a number of places where that could come in. I think it could form a separate point. This is a very personal thing, a narcissistic thing. I have two friends who don't feel that I have a theology which is big as the city. I can become quite apocalyptic about urban living, and I think that's a fault within my thinking at the moment. So rather, there's so many issues here, and I keep laying it aside, but it's one that I'm getting to grips with. I've got a lot of convictions about, but I'm kind of just leaving it aside just for the moment. But helpful observation. I think a lot of these things are exacerbated within the city. I think the disintegration factor is often exacerbated there. Consumer factor in terms of advertising, what we're confronted with there. Think of the graphics revolution, information revolution. A lot of these things are kind of brought together in an extreme form in the city.
It might just be in the sense that it kind of marks this kind of land in the landscape of Western human consciousness. It kind of marks a huge, I don't know, shift in thinking when there's that concentration of so many people, and that was definitely a new aspect of that experience, I think.
Yeah, although I think if you look, you know, in history, there have been many conurbations which were well populated before the Industrial Revolution. So the highly populated city isn't a phenomenon of that arises out of modernity. But I think there's something with the character of the modern city that reflects modernity in all sorts of ways.
Yeah. The other question that I have is, when you talked about the blurring of the boundaries between the real and the representation in the Sunil Opera, I was wondering if you might think of that as just a kind of a procedure that all cultures have kind of been involved in for a long time. And I'm thinking like something like a mythopoetic view of reality is almost precisely that. Kind of taking and understanding real phenomena in terms of like a system of symbols, to where in the end that system of symbols becomes what is real. And it would seem to me that that's this taking the image to be the real might just be another expression of a mythology.
Hmm.
And maybe would you think of the image as potentially just a postmodern myth in that model?
Some have presented in those terms. I'm, as you know, doing quite a bit of research at the moment on mythology, and I see no evidence of the myth, which was a signifier, becoming the signified. I don't see that at all. It functioned in much the same way as a painting functions. It was a way of trying to reach beyond the material reality, to get to grips with that, and as I say, in my reading and observation so far, I haven't seen that blurring at all. And the myth actually became a way of interpreting the real. And you take the Greek myths, one doesn't get a sense even that they took the gods of their mythologies that seriously. There were some that they did, but no, I actually feel that the graphic image functions in a very different way. The example I like to use, which is more clear-cut, is the painting, the way a piece of fine art reflects reality and the way the graphic image functions with respect to reality. There's two different things happening. But this, yeah, the simulacra argument, it has been critiqued by a number of people, and not everyone accepts it. I mean, I don't want to accept it fully, because if it's true, as I say, the consequences are terrifying, given how many we're exposed to.
Andrew, have you seen the film The Matrix?
No, I haven't yet.
Well, Keanu Reeves' character, before he gets hijacked into this other reality, is actually, it happens very fast if you're not aware, you miss it, but the book he was reading when he was snatched was Samurka.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Huh. Hmm. You had your hand up earlier.
Yes, taking back to your original premise, the separation between the private life and the public life, and how the modern man defines himself according to his personal private needs. The question occurs to me is, if that is true, then why is it that so many people in the modern world, particularly men, define themselves by their
what they do in their work? Yes.
Rather than the fact that they are fly fishermen or play the cornet. You know, why is it, oh, I'm an accountant, I'm an engineer, this is who I am?
Yeah. No, I think that's true. It's a way that one of the ways that they define themselves. I'm not sure there's. I don't meet many today who find it's a way that they fulfill themselves. They try and define themselves, but they don't fulfill themselves. In fact, I think this separation accounts for part of the reason why so many are unhappy in their work today. It doesn't fulfill the needs of the self because of the description I gave of the public world. But it's a good point. I think that does happen. I think you're absolutely right there.
But I think the reason for that is just because since it's only one part of your life, and presume it's a good part of your life, so you do something you're really good at, you're talented for, you're trained in, and you do where your gifts lie, that's just then they only see your good side, if you want, and you only get your feedback for your good side. So very often, if it's going well at work, then people like you, you got good feedback, you really, everything works great, and then you come home, and then all the other areas of your life that are maybe poorer developed, they get also feedback, which much worse feedback. So wives tell you, and the children say, oh wow, what do I do with my children? Yeah, got angry again, I shouldn't shout at them and stuff. And so what you do gradually, I go to the fields where I am good at. I think it's the same way we function of churches and stuff. Very often people just can clean everything, sports, or, but just only it's one part of it, and just specialize on the part you're best at.
Yeah.
Which ultimately leads you to non-fulfillment. But it's very tempting, I think.
Yeah. That category, those categories of private and public, I think work very, very well in terms of looking at modernity. Where you put the various categories of our life, there aren't as clear cut. And I think there's a point at where our jobs, although it's a move into the public world, are actually very much part of our private spheres too. So there wouldn't want to be too dogmatic in terms of how I place them. One point I want to make about this disintegration factor, coming back to another recent film, is The Truman Show intrigued me, and maybe there's a prophetic element here, in that it almost seemed to be pitting, and there's a line that used the whole idea of private and public very, very explicitly. The whole idea that these two have become so separate from each other, they're going to kind of rebound back, and the two becomes one. So in this film, the private and the public is annihilated. That Truman's life becomes open to the whole public world. His whole life is on display. And I don't think, because all dualisms are unnatural, and this is an unnatural dualism, that can go on forever. So there comes a point where I actually think the Truman Show might have something in it. The two will kind of come back together again. James?
Concerning graphics and all that, just being in the textile arts and dealing with graphics for a little while, I just think it was so powerful because it leaves no room for interpretation to where a good impressionist painting does, and it does point to, towards the real in a special way. But a graphic, it will, as you said, will devour that, and it leaves no room for the human mind to have an interpretation of it. I think it's what's so dangerous.
Interesting, yeah.
Second of all, a question really quick. I'm really concerned, firstly, with myself, with what you said about the schizophrenic Christian. I tend to think it's good for me to have this church self, this school self, this family self, and all this, but I really experienced tension with that. Big time. That really struck me, what you said. And I was just curious how, not how to solve it, but do you think that it's especially harsh for the Christian, and is there, what do we do? I know you don't want to answer that question directly.
Well, I think it's worse for the Christian simply because we have this added world of church usually in our lives. So it creates one more world that we have to move across into. It's the one area where I feel I can speak out of personal experience with some authority because I live a very different world. My world, I would say the chief for me privilege of being at La Brie in a community like this is the integration of this world. That my home, my work, my family, my social context. I mean, I'm stuck with Wade as a friend, but still, I mean, it's all integrated here. I have to start getting him back. He's been saying some bad stuff about me the last few weeks. It's all integrated together. Now, this is not a perfect life, believe me. That integration causes other tensions. That is, I have to get on with Wade. And I'm serious. That's part of the tension. I can't kind of... You know, if I was working with Wade in the office and I didn't like him, least I can leave him behind. But there's something with the integration here that it's much harder to do that. But the integration I've experienced here at La Brie it might not look like it, has brought a sanity. A sanity to my existence, which is worth all the money in the world. I mean that. It is the great privilege of working here. It's also why people who leave La Brie struggle greatly. Because suddenly all this disintegration comes back into their life and they've got all these different worlds. How we overcome it, there's no easy practical solution. We live in modernity. Like my point with consumerism, I defy you. Break out of it. Become an ascetic. Yeah, I mean, God calls us to live in this world. If anything, this makes me long for heaven. Now, there's a lot more to it than that. I'm not just saying head in the sand, wait for heaven. But this is bad. This is not good for our humanity. And this disintegration between our various worlds, it causes, I believe, a schizophrenia. Not clinical, but it's a real type of schizophrenia and it's bad. And we've got to try and bring the integration principle into our lives as much as possible. And that might mean saying no to some of our worlds as much as we can. And we need to be very careful there, because if we say no to all our worlds out here and just have our private world, we just become more narcissistic. There has to be service at the center of it. But this is what I do practically with quite a few students here. Just let's get practical. Let's look at your life. What can we simplify? Where can we bring integration? And I believe it's something which is possible. Never do it perfectly, but we can strive towards it.
I just wonder, with the integration factor by mass media now, especially in the States, you have a public figure, but there all of a sudden there comes the private in, you know, sexual affairs 20, 25 years ago, and you would maybe see it last 2 years, but then you look 25 years back and all this kind of stuff. How would you interpret that? Is it also kind of a rebound there, or is it kind of rather ill watching and just grasping for whatever sensation from that? Or is it also kind of, oh, we want to know this figure a bit more, kind of an ill attempt for reintegration?
Yeah, great, great question. Why are we so voyeuristic with respect to those who inhabit the public worlds? I mean, even Sherry Blair gets pregnant, which is a wonderful piece of news, and everybody goes bananas, and you think of the royal family watchers and all the scandal with Bill Clinton. I mean, let's throw it open. Why is it that with respect to public figures, we are so voyeuristic? We want a peek into that world. More than a peek, I think we're besotted with it. That's what sells papers. In fact, I notice more and more that the broadsheets are becoming more tabloid by the week. I see this with the Times. I've just about given up with it now. It's a broadsheet tabloid now. Doug?
I think it has something to do with not finding a heck of a lot of interest in one's own life.
Boredom.
Just boredom and boredom is where you think it's more interesting over there because you don't have to what happened here. And so you have to sort of eavesdrop on someone else's conversation because... I think that's sort of almost a byproduct, almost.
Yeah.
Process.
Interesting. Caroline?
I think it's due to the globalism and the fact that we don't have community. We don't have a nuclear family, we don't have a community anymore.
Mm.
And where we used to have role models in the community, and we've always, or in family, we've always wanted, I mean, through time, we've always wanted role models.
Mm.
And now we don't have that. So we only have this global village, this global community, and those are the only sort of role models
mm.
that we really have.
Yeah, interesting. Public role models. I mean, it's a bizarre concept, isn't it?
Well, that's the only family that we all relate to.
Yeah.
We all see them on our televisions, we all see them in the newspapers.
Yeah.
Whereas we don't talk to our neighbours. but we need some community in some sense, and that's all that we get.
Yeah. Interesting. Mark? Both of those things I can see truth in.
I was just going to observe that in your analysis of these great movements, you haven't mentioned many key figures, key people who have been responsible movements that have happened, unless it seems to me there are ideas and passion somehow taken on. I see it as a movement into insanity eventually.
Mm.
It's a virtual reality, then the next step will be insanity. But I was just wondering whether you'd agree with these three, which come to my mind, which would be Darwin being a key figure for the progress and the
mm-hmm.
metaphor, and then I'd say Freud in his self-consciousness in the early part of the century, and then Marx in his economic autonomy.
Mm.
No?
Definitely. Now that, I've actually already given the lecture that precedes this on causes, which is the ideological causes, the thinkers who have led to that. And I would put all three of those in that category. Now again, I don't want to create a false dualism here, but the whole interaction between ideas shaping culture and sociological phenomena shaping culture is a very interesting debate. And some stress one where the other stress the other. I think they're both very bound up with each other, but I think it's important to actually separate them apart in order to look at them in as coherent a way as possible. So I think that the causes are as linked. I start with ideas, because actually the culprit for me, and this poor group of students heard me do a lecture on this guy recently from a different angle, but the culprit here is Descartes. I think, therefore I am. That was a shift to self-consciousness with respect to knowledge that was monumental in terms of philosophical thought. He put it right there in the eye, and he started from the place of doubt. And the whole place that he stood in, as the father of modernism, I think that the worldview of self was right there in seed form in Descartes. But I mentioned Freud. He's an obvious figure in terms of self-consciousness. All of those guys. Helpful, yeah.
Andrew, do you see this as a particularly Christian concern, or because I don't think of Tolstoy as being a religious man himself, is this a lecture that could have been given and are the concerns all things that purely sociological, other than the church world? Is there a particular Christian, certainly the solution one would predict you would come up with would be particularly but are the problems recognized by people of faith and people without
him? Almost all of my sources are non-Christian sources here. Starting with Christopher Larsh, The Culture of Narcissism. The only solutions are rooted in the Judeo-Christian worldview, as far as I'm concerned. But, I mean, I'll be honest, this is my dream. And believe me, there is no pretentiousness here at all. I recognize how limited this material is, but I would love for a non-Christian publisher to take this on, because I think this applies to the whole world. It's not until you get to the end, but if you can kind of show the roots of the problem on a common ground level, and then show that only Christianity has an answer to it, I think it's the sort of thing that would really lend itself to a publisher which is not Christian. It's finding one.
I've been trying to work through causes in what you've been saying, and in your reference to narcissism, it sounded as if you were going to say that self was the villain of the piece somehow. But in most of the most of the things that are represented by your list on the board there, self seemed to be the victim. It was almost the accidental, you know, it was the outcome of these historical trends and changes and so on, which nobody intended necessarily in the total picture. But it was an unfortunate byproduct of all that, that we as individuals lose our sense of identity and self and so on. And yet I thought from the title, as it were, you would be saying, well, this is the product of selfishness.
That's a very helpful point. What I say in one of my previous lectures on this is that selfishness is not a metaphor. Sorry, narcissism is not a metaphor of the human condition. Selfishness is, narcissism isn't. Not all cultures throughout all times have been narcissistic. I think it's actually something which is quite peculiar to our culture. And I do some work to show that the pre-modern, the pagan pre-modern, was not a narcissist. That he was, he and she were responding to the other. So, but to your point, I think it's a very, that's a helpful observation, because I don't want to portray the self simply as a victim, and yet we were born into this world. That's what I mean by the form of prostitution. You know, it's a type of slavery. But I would root, going back to the Industrial Revolution, I said modernity is premised on bottom-up causation, human design. That's where the problem went wrong, and that replaced the top-down causation. That's where things went bad.